Tom Wolfe's best-selling novel, The Bonfire of the Vanities, is a portrait of New York in the late 1980s. It's about a wealthy Wall Street trader, Sherman McCoy, who gets lost with his mistress in the Bronx one night, and they accidentally hit a black teenager with their car after an altercation. The ensuing investigation brings out the us-against-them mentality of a New York City divided by race and class, and the simmering resentment between the haves and have-nots. To celebrate the novel's 25th anniversary, we've selected it for the Leonard Lopecio Book Club. It's available in paperback from Picador, and Tom Wolfe joins us now to discuss it. Welcome to our show.
Well, thank you very much.
And we hope that our listeners who've been reading the book will join the conversation. You can leave a question or comment on our show page at WMYC.org, or you can call us at 212-433-9692. Tom, we should mention that you have a new novel out called Back to Blood. But it takes place in Miami. Is the new New York no longer a good setting for a novel?
Actually, New York is like Paris in the 19th century. You can't miss if you really do New York right. And if I do another novel, it will certainly be about set in New York.
But Back to Blood is also about race and class.
Well,
and immigration.
I don't know why more writers don't face up to the fact that there are racial tension in this country, a lot of it. And it's not just black and white. I mean, there are lots of Latins have moved in, and there will be a lot more, believe me.
And we saw that during this election.
Oh, yes.
There was an awful lot of coded racial talk.
I'm telling you, people are so afraid to say anything in this area. It's pathetic. I mean, oh, my God. I'll tell you something strange, though. Both political correctness and Marxism come straight from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, in which he said, the last shall be first, the first shall be last, the meek shall inherit the earth. What did Marx think the proletariat was? If you told him it was from Jesus, he would have probably slit his own throat. But it was.
Well, he was a convert. His family, anyway, converted to Christianity. So maybe he would have known that.
Well, I think that was a show conversion. But
it is interesting to see how that has all changed to some degree in American politics, where evangelicals are much more conservative. Before you began writing fiction, you were one of the pioneers of the new journalism. Did that lead you to writing the kinds of novels you wrote?
Well, in a way it did, because I was newspaper reporter for four newspapers. I wrote lots of magazine articles for Esquire and New York Magazine. And I was going to write a nonfiction novel along the lines of Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. And so I was rummaging around, I shouldn't have been, in the office of David Halberstam. He wasn't there, at Harper's Magazine, while I was waiting for my wife to be to finish what she was doing. And I saw this incredible invitation. Mr. and Mrs. Leonard Bernstein invite you to a party for the Black Panthers at 895 Park Avenue. And I said, I've got to go to this thing.
And so you crashed the party.
Well, I crashed. You had to be careful, though. I took down the telephone number you're supposed to call to accept. And I took a chance and said, this is Tom Wolfe. I accept. And I figured there'd be somebody with a yellow pad at some committee taking down the names of the people who are going to come. And sure enough, it was. So they had a security check at the entrance to the apartment. I won't go over that story, but just think of Leonard Bernstein sitting down by his piano listening to a lecture by the Black Panther Field Marshal, and he's worn a turtleneck for the occasion. Men didn't wear turtlenecks to parties in those days. And he's saying, right on, right on. But he says right on. He lifts his left fist. I mean, this is, you know, this is real commitment. Well, the old fire bell rang, and I couldn't save it for any book. And I just went down. I had to write it.
So there went
the nonfiction novel. So I said, well, all right, I'll try fiction for the first time in my life.
And that led to characters like Larry Kramer, the lawyer in the Bronx DA's office in Bonfire, who's very focused on how he appears to others. He's self-conscious about his beat-up briefcase. He says it don't matter in certain company instead of it doesn't matter. He wears sneakers on the subway. And that's because we were all very, well, some of us still are, very conscious of how the world is going to perceive us at first glance. But I was wondering, in the new journalism, there were certain stylistic similarities to fiction. The writer's often a presence in the writing in a way that a reporter usually isn't. And did that allow you to approach things in a more complex way, dealing with the ambiguities of a story?
Well, I used the first person singular I in a couple of pieces early in the game. And then it dawned on me that unless I actually was a part of the story somehow, it was wrong to try that. I solve the problem of point of view, but it's your point of view. And if you weren't there, let's say I wrote a book about the astronauts. I didn't fly with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was...
Because you didn't have the right stuff?
Actually, let me tell you how the thing started, because I thought, maybe I do have it. The first seven astronauts were all not only white, but white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, if you ever heard that term before. And they were all from intact families, or so the public was led to believe. They were all from stable homes. They were all from small towns. And except for the small town part, that was pretty much my description. So I was thinking about, God, what is it about us that's so fabulous? Only to find out that they were all white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, because the whole officer corps was at that time. These were all military officers. Another thing I forgot to mention, four of them had Junior after the name, and I have Junior after my name. So, hey, this is really getting down to brass tacks. And they...
Were they all from Virginia?
No, but they could have been. Actually, they were all from so many states. But anyway, the fact that they were Junior attests to the birth rate, which has dropped so sharply during the Depression. If there were two children, that was rare enough. But if they were both, if there was one male, and only males could join the Corps of Astronauts at that time, then the chances of that being Junior was very high. And it turned out that what really bound those men together was what I had to name, but they would never talk about it, the right stuff.
But later, when we had, when it was open to women, in fact, Ellen Baker, one of the astronauts, is the daughter of Claire Shulman, the former Queensborough president. She had to have the right stuff, too, even though she wasn't a WASP male.
Well, not to detract from her ability. But the government became very politically correct about those flights. And these were bigger flights, from the space shuttle and so on. And the crew did not have the piloting responsibility on board. So they became very PC at NASA. And we're going to have one of everything if we can possibly get it. They had to meet some rather rigid requirements, but I don't know her. She's probably a wonderful, brave woman, but things had changed.
Let's get back to the Bonfire of the Vanities, which is the subject of our book club. It captures a time and a place really well. Could you write this story now, 25 years later?
It would be very different in certain ways. The Chairman McCoy was a salesman on a bond trading floor. And the bond trading floor, the traders and the salesmen were like heroic he-men. They would make these decisions, which took a lot of bravery, you know, to commit your company to 6 million shares of something. And it was considered the closest thing to combat that you could possibly have, with one slight difference. The death in combat in Wall Street was statistically nil. They were practically all under 40. Even if they got into a blood-curdling rage, they weren't going to have a stroke. They'd get over it. Later on, there was a Wall Street trader named John Coates who suddenly quit the business. People were astounded. He was very successful. And he went to his alma mater, Cambridge University in England, and re-enlisted at Cambridge as a neuroscientist because he was so curious as to what is it that makes accounts for these very macho and somewhat wild young men who trade on Wall Street. And he did endocrine studies of things like testosterone, and he learned many remarkable things, such as if a man came in with unusually high testosterone level, he was more likely to be successful during the day. A lot of things like that, which were, I think, quite fascinating. But today, those characteristics of the being a mad bull or a toreador or a Navy SEAL, or they're all the same, don't apply any longer.
You don't think the people on Wall Street are just as testosterone-driven?
No. I think they're closer to being zeros today.
Studies indicate that even the women involved have higher testosterone levels when they're engaged in those activities.
Well, they probably do, but so much of the trading now is done electronically, by which I mean you keep hearing about algorithms. They set these algorithms, which are sequences of choices, into an electrical system, and the machine actually does the trading, and the machine spots the opportunities. So about 75% of all trading is done by so-called high-frequency trading machines.
But in your book, everybody seems to want to get theirs, even if it means taking someone else down. And we hear stories like that even today. No?
Oh, I think the story of New York could be summed up as taking people down. But it was very much that. It was very much the He-Man was the winner.
My guest is Tom Wolfe, and we're talking about The Bonfire of the Vanities, which is still in print and is celebrating its 25th anniversary, now available in paperback from Picador. Didn't you originally write this as a serialized novel in Rolling Stone? And one of our listeners, Susan, left this comment on our show page. She said, "I read Bonfire when it was serialized in Rolling Stone magazine and look forward so eagerly to each issue. The main character was a novelist living on the Upper East Side, and I thought it was a brilliant characterization. And then the book came out, and he was transformed into a Wall Street man, and his behavior made him less sympathetic. Why the change?"
Well, I was lazy, and when I wrote the serial, and I figured, well, I don't have to learn about writers. I mean, I know all about that. But I put him on a choice block about 75th Street of Park Avenue. And I started thinking, I don't know of a single writer who lives on a good part of Park Avenue, maybe Park Avenue South or somebody.
Today you'd have to put him in Park Slope.
Yeah, you're right. You know, the populations of both the white population of New York, Manhattan, no, New York City, has greatly increased thanks to Brooklyn and all of the gentrification in Brooklyn, Park Slope, you mentioned, and in what is used to be called South Harlem. It's now called Soha. You get that nickname, which really attracts people. They're coming into something special. But young couples will go there to have children, whereas in the rest of Manhattan, they're not likely. So many people, it's too bad in Manhattan. You have one child and they move out.
Well, the housing stock in Soha is quite beautiful, and that's something we've seen with gentrification. Neighborhoods that had perhaps been in decline for one reason or another, but where the buildings themselves were quite beautiful, they are the first to become gentrified.
And they're very close to, well, they are part of Manhattan, and they're very convenient. So I think it's logical, but just those two groups of gentrifiers have expanded the white population.
So you decided when you wrote the novel to put your stockbroker there instead.
Yeah, I had hearing stories about the wild times that and the tremendous fortunes that these young men were having or had on Wall Street. So I managed to get into the bond trading floor. Bonds were everything at that time. Stocks were nothing. The bond trading floor at Salomon Brothers, which no longer exists. But I sat at the left hand of the number one government bond trader during an auction, which is the wildest scene of all. And I think in those 2 days, I saw so many things that I felt that I was able now to write about it. And it was, as you said, I mean, it was so much more appropriate than to have a writer as the main character.
And from the start, was it also about the haves and the have-nots? And
I didn't so much think of it that way as, well, I guess I did, because I was thinking of New York High and Low. Vanity Fair by Thackeray, which was my model, as I read it again, I could see this was really about the upper orders. Maybe there failed people in the upper orders and so on, but they were all in the upper orders of British society. So I realized it had to be New York High and Low. You couldn't do that in New York and get a picture of the city.
A listener, Nellie from Bridgewater, New Jersey, left this comment on our show page. This is one of my favorite all-time books. As a native French speaker, it was my first English novel. It's a wonderful story, and I have to say, as a foreigner, seeing all the ignorant things being said about President Obama, things have not changed at all. The U.S. still has one of the greatest racial class divisions in the world.
Today, I would amend that slightly because the real story of ethnicity, race, nationality today is the tremendous rise in the number of Latins. And the only way you can tell what the New York population is to look at the public school statistics, because all the other there's so many people are illegal aliens or people that just don't want to call attention to themselves that the gross numbers don't matter. Today, the New York is about 40 in public schools, about 40% Latin.
And all of the post-election analysis suggests that one of the ways the Republican Party really hurt itself was in not going after that the Hispanic vote. And of course, you're addressing that to some degree in your new book.
Well, I think the Republican Party was buffaloed because they didn't want to lose Florida. And at the time, it seemed as if the Miami area's Cuban vote was very important. Well, it turns out I'm not sure they even got that segment, because there's a lot of Puerto Ricans in Miami who you never hear about.
And new generation Cubans don't always share the opinions their parents have about American politics.
They have tended, the new generation, to you know, support their parents' viewpoint, but not with any passion.
Do you have much sympathy for the characters in this book? I mean, none of them are villains, but I wouldn't say that any of them are particularly likable, the kind of person that a reader might want to identify with.
Well, when this book came out, there were reviews saying Wolf has painted a very bleak picture of life in New York. And I said to myself, what do you mean? I'm just saying, look at that one. Look at this one. I was wonderstruck by the sort of people I wrote about in The Bonfire of the Vanities. And, you know, you talk about sympathetic characters. When the movie, when Warner Brothers bought the movie, movie rights, they discovered that just what you've just mentioned, there were no sympathetic characters. And oh, my God, at the end, there's this Jewish judge lecturing a black protest movement. And so they said, God, we can't have this. We'll get Morgan Freeman. He'll be the one who lectures the black protesters. And then they said, God, this guy Sherman McCoy, he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He treats women terribly. Here's what we'll do. We'll get Tom Hanks. Nobody can dislike Tom Hanks. I never said a word about the film way back then.
It pretty much undermined much of the point of the book.
Absolutely. I mean, I had cashed the check, so I felt impolite to talk about it.
Well, sometimes they actually consult with the writer, but they didn't in this case, I imagine, because they suspected that you would have fought for what you had in the book.
Well, I don't know, they actually did at the outset ask me if I wanted to be involved. But I did, you know, if something is turned into a movie, a book, it's not going to be your book. It can be something fabulous, or it can be something not so fabulous, but it's not going to be your book on the screen. It just can't happen.
Do you ever miss writing journalism?
Oh, I miss it all the time.
Because there must be stories that occur to you that you think, well, I'm not sure that would make a novel anyway. I'm not sure I want to devote all the time to writing a novel, but boy, that would make a wonderful article.
Well, my current novel, Back to Blood, is essentially about immigration. Not how immigrants get in, which is colorful enough, but how they fare once they're in the United States. And Miami is just immigration central. I mean, everybody has immigrated recently.
Tom, thank you so much for being on our show today to talk about this month's selection of the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club, The Bonfire of the Vanities, now celebrating its 25th anniversary, available in paperback from Picador.
Listen, thanks so much for having me, Leonard. I really do appreciate it.